Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we continue our month-long series of programs devoted to the war in Vietnam by examining the role the media played in the war, how the war was covered, and how that coverage affected politics and even military policy. Our guests will be William Hammond and Lou Carlson. But before we hear from them, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on January 16, 1964, President Lyndon Johnson approved Oplon 34A. U.S. forces were ordered to support the South Vietnamese in intelligence and sabotage operations intended to destabilize the North Vietnamese regime. South Vietnamese commandos raided North Vietnamese coastal and island installations. American forces were not involved, but U.S. Navy ships monitored North Vietnamese troop movements. One of those ships, the USS Maddox, came under attack, and 2 days later, both the Maddox and the destroyer USS C. Turner Joy battled North Vietnamese patrol boats. That altercation led to what would be called the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. By that resolution, voted August 7, 1964, Congress voted its support for the President to, quote, take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. The U.S. began its major escalation of involvement in the war in Vietnam.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Ray Wallace has died, and his family members say they can now reveal the truth. Ray Wallace was Bigfoot. He did it just for the joke, they report, and then he was afraid to tell anybody because they'd be mad at him. It all began in August 1958 when bulldozer operator Jerry Crew, who worked for Wallace's construction company in Humboldt County, California, found huge footprints circling his rig. The Humboldt Times in Eureka coined the term Bigfoot in a front-page story about the discovery, and the legend was launched. Wallace asked a friend to carve 16-inch long feet that he and his brother Wilbur slipped on to create the tracks, it appears. And when the joke became a national phenomenon, they milked it for what it was worth. They cut a record of supposed Bigfoot sounds and published films and photographs of the creature eating elk and sitting on a log munching cereal.
But you know, Brian, that diehard fans don't believe it. They say that the Bigfoot legend and Bigfoot sightings go all the way back to the 1800s. They still think he's out there. Somewhere.
This is Talking History. First of our series of shows on the history of American involvement in the Vietnam War, we focused on the air war. This week we examined the role of the media. Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, takes up the subject with his guest, William Hammond.
In time of war, democratic governments can find themselves trying to win two struggles, for military victory in the field and for public opinion at home. According to my guest, William Hammond, the history of warfare in the 19th and 20th centuries is often as much a history of governmental attempts to control the press as a chronicle of battles. Media coverage of the war in Vietnam was a source of conflict in the 1960s and has remained controversial ever since. William Hammond, a senior historian with the U.S. Army Center of Military History, is the author of Public Affairs, The Military and the Media, a two-volume study of the often contentious relationship between the U.S. military and the press during the Vietnam War. Dr. Hammond, welcome.
Thank you.
The military and the media were generally on friendly terms during World War II and the Korean War, and going into Vietnam, they had what you've described as a cooperative relationship. What was the nature of that relationship?
Well, in general, the military provided them with transportation, housing in the field, access to briefings, and to the PX, because they needed American-style things in an Asian country, and in return asked them to abide by certain rules. Basically, they were not to mention forthcoming operations until the commander in the field gave them the word to do so. They were not to, after a time, the rule was made that they were not to reveal the number of casualties in more than general terms, light, heavy, or moderate, in order to deny the enemy information that he could use in upcoming battles. Not to reveal the amount of fuel or ammunition in a supply system or an ammunition dump or with the unit in the field that's fighting, and so on. The kind of things that would give the enemy an edge.
Now that process is still in effect at the beginning of the Vietnam War. You mentioned in your book that the press observed voluntary guidelines beginning in 1962 on what it should report.
That's right.
Could you talk more specifically about the guidelines as they applied to Vietnam and how well they worked?
Well, the guidelines, as I said, dealt basically with military-type information that could be dangerous if it got out into the public. The media didn't particularly like the rule about American casualties. They, particularly the one that said that everything should be held in terms of light, heavy, or moderate, they felt that that was just an attempt on the part of officialdom to cover up its own incompetence at times. And there were major disagreements between them and the military over, well, you say these were light casualties, but in fact I was there, the reporter would say, and I saw X number of men fall dead or wounded, and that looked like an awful lot to me. So why do you say this is light when I would say it was heavy? And they would come back and explain that it's all a matter of the perspective in which you see it. There were 1,000 men involved with this operation, and you, the reporter, just happened to be at the very point where the heaviest fighting was, and you saw all the casualties. But in the context of the 1,000, the few men that you saw fall, while it looked heavy to you, was not heavy in terms of the effort.
How closely did U.S. government and military leaders read press accounts of the war in Vietnam? Were they monitoring it pretty closely?
Oh, they read them very carefully, particularly in Washington, which if it saw something it didn't like, would then pressure General Westmoreland or General Abrams to go after that reporter and set him straight or whatever. And in general, the commander in the field had more perspective than the people in Washington, and while he might indeed correct a reporter, very often he would sit down with his public affairs officers and they will come to the conclusion that, well, the man couldn't have said very much else different, and it was altogether a fair comment, and why don't we just forget about it instead of making a big deal and making it worse than it was to start with. That's the way they would handle things.
You describe a visit that Vice President Hubert Humphrey made to Vietnam in 1967, during which he told reporters, "When you speak to the American people, give the benefit of the doubt to our side. I don't think that's asking too much. We're in this together." And you continue the story. A reporter muttered to one next to him, "Benefit of a doubt? What did I think we've been doing for the past 6 years?" Obviously, this formerly cooperative relationship was unraveling by the time Humphrey was in Vietnam in 1967.
Well, it was slowly beginning to do so, but frankly, the reporters, largely in their reporting, favored government policy in the early half of the war and even later. You have to understand the nature of reporting in the field. Very few reporters got out into the combat areas on any given day, purely and simply because they had to represent their company, which had one man in Vietnam, and that it was them. It was them, or they basically had to file a report every day, and if they went out into the field, they might be out there for days and days and see nothing. Whereas if they stayed in Saigon, they would always have the benefit of the official briefings and an overview of whatever had happened in the country in that day. The upshot of this is that, for all practical purposes, in reporting on the information they had on the interview and so on, they relayed the official point of view.
To make that more personal. There are reporters such as Neil Sheehan and David Halberstam who become identified later as vociferous critics of the war who, as you suggest, start out as actually supporters.
They were supporters, and frankly, they were all gone. Many of those fellows were gone by 1966. David Halberstam had gone back to Washington or to New York, so had Neil Sheehan. There are very few reporters stayed for long periods of time. One of the foremost is Peter Arnett. And frankly, if you look at the bulk of Peter Arnett's reporting, it's quite factual. He does, on occasion, do a critical report, but usually it's pretty well-founded.
The Tet Offensive in January of 1968 is often seen as a turning point in American public opinion toward the war. Shortly after that, Walter Cronkite made his famous editorial against American involvement there. How did the government view media coverage of Tet, and how significant was it actually in changing America's opinions about the war?
Well, number one, media coverage of Tet was pretty critical. You have to see it and some of it was erroneous, but you have to see it in terms of what preceded it. The government, official spokesmen in Vietnam and in Washington were very optimistic about this war. We talk about the General Westmoreland making the comment in his November speech to the National Press Club, November 67, that the enemy could no longer fight his large units near Vietnam cities and was fighting further and further into the hinterlands. And comments like this, the pacification program is succeeding, the effort to win the hearts and minds of the people. We are controlling more and more of the population with each passing month in the countryside. All of these comments come to roost on the Tet Offensive, where the enemy attacks every single city of any importance in South Vietnam over a two-day period. Giving the lie to General Westmoreland's comments and the other comments that have been made that were so optimistic. And the media reacted, and it jumped to conclusions. For example, it took them quite a considerable amount of time to concede that the enemy had never entered the American embassy in his attack there. Quite erroneously, they made that assertion again and again and again, even though the facts seemed to contradict it. They were building their stories on the basis of the word of soldiers at the scene of action who didn't really have a grip on the totality of what was going on and only saw their own small piece of the battle. The reporters are working from partial information just like the soldiers are and reporting partial information when probably they should have stepped back and given it a little distance and a little consideration, which is hard to do in the thick of battle. As for American public opinion, I think you can make a very strong case that the American public suspended its judgment of the Tet Offensive and, in fact, held back and waited for its president to make a decision. Up to that point, public opinion had fallen in step with American losses, particularly casualties. It fell 15 percentage points every time casualties went up by a factor of 10. When they went from 1,000 to 10,000, 10,000 to 100,000 killed and wounded, American public opinion, as measured by the Gallup poll, would fall about 15 percentage points. This is true both for Korea and for Vietnam. You can say that, just because there's a correlation between two figures, it doesn't mean that one is causing the other, and that's altogether true. But the fact is, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it happens in two wars, you better think pretty hard about it. But the public at Tet suspended judgment, and those figures just kind of hover there, despite the fighting in the field. And when Johnson, in March, basically says he's not going to run again and is going to seek peace. And he, at that point, sets his policy and the public opinion just continues then to fall. You can make a case that public opinion would have gone up in support of the president if he had decided to mass a huge number of troops and to go into Vietnam with full speed and end this war. Public opinion would probably have supported him, just as it supported President Bush after September the 11th, and so on. When the president makes an important decision, the public will give him the space to work his policy. They always have.
By the mid-1960s, critics of President Johnson charged that he suffered from what they called a credibility gap. There was a difference between what he said and what the actual facts were. Was there a credibility gap?
Oh, yes, there was. And, of course, that's the reason why the reaction to the Tet Offensive was so emphatic on the part of many reporters. And you'll find that following Tet in 1969, that reporters who had always kind of been cheerleaders for American policy in Vietnam, our troops are charging, the sort of reporting that you'll hear, they would label the communists and so on. After 1969, they no longer were the cheerleaders. They simply said, instead of the communists, which is always a red flag word in the Cold War America, they would simply say the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong or some more neutral term. And they stopped talking about our side and their side. And it simply became the opponents or whatever.
One of the conclusions that you come to is that, in the end, the American public seems to have become skeptical of both the press and the government, coming to its own conclusions about the war, that the press coverage, whether biased or incomplete or not, seemed not to matter to the public as much as casualties.
Well, that's exactly true, and you can track that, as I said, throughout the whole war. And that is probably a feature of other wars as well, although it's much more difficult to track, for example, in World War II and so on. The public, at some point, begins to balance means and ends and losses and to think very hard about whether it wants to keep doing this. The public was not going to turn against the President of the United States until we got the prisoners of war back. But it's quite clear that Congress itself turned against this war in 1972, and the president's main supporters in Congress, Barry Goldwater, Strom Thurmond, people like that, notified him that if he had not made peace with the North Vietnamese, by the time the new Congress and Senate were installed in, what is it, February of 1973, they would personally introduce a bill to cut off all funding for the war.
What lessons did the government and the media take from Vietnam? Or, to ask the question a slightly different way, what has the relationship been? How has it changed since Vietnam?
Well, there was a lot of skepticism on the part of the media toward anything the government had to say in terms of war following Vietnam, and I think you can probably say that it extends into the present. There's also an awful lot of anger on the part of the military as to how they were dealt with by the media in Vietnam that endures even to this day. I think, however, that both sides have learned an awful lot in the intervening years, and also an awful lot of people who weren't even alive in the Vietnam period are now reporting war or leading units in the field in the Army and the various military services who don't have the kind of experience of the opposition between the two sides that was very much a feature of that earlier conflict. And they are working, in effect, from a blank slate and taking things at face value. And when reporters and military people cooperate today, both sides feel good about the relationship. When points of friction occur, there are new points of friction rather than points that are built on bygones.
Well, Doctor,
so they're, in effect, constructing a whole new relationship in the current period. Can we say that, the military and the media will cooperate from now on? Well, they never have. One group exists essentially to open up information about everything, the media. The other group cannot exist if information is opened up on every possible aspect of a war. So they are, in effect, different cultures and always will be. They're going to get along. They have to get along in a democracy. Your first question about the whole thrust of American history and so on is very much on the point of this whole issue, because in fact the military and the media have never gotten along in American history. You go look at every single war, every war America has ever fought, and every war that any democracy ever fights is always at its core a public relations war. The public ultimately must support the war or the war isn't going to happen because the public has its hands on the purse strings. If they don't want to pay, it isn't going to happen. And this is what Richard Nixon found in dealing with Congress in 1972. They weren't going to pay anymore. And if you go back to the Civil War, General Grant even says, if this war had gone on one more year, Congress and the Senate, at the instigation of the American public, would have cut off funding for the war and the South would have gone its way.
Well, Dr. Hammond, thank you for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
I've been visiting with William Hammond, a senior historian for the U.S. Army Center of Military History.
Come at last, gotta go out, get those reds. The only good commie is the one that's dead. And you know the peace can only be won when the glory of all the kingdom come.
And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
As we just heard, media coverage directly influenced American attitudes toward the Vietnam War and even how the war was fought. But just how did that experience affect news coverage of subsequent military engagements? That's the subject of this week's commentary by Lou Carlson. Carlson, a retired professor of history and director of American studies at Western Michigan University, is the author of We Were Each Other's Prisoners, an oral history of World War II American and German prisoners of war.
One of the most fascinating questions that persists about that most controversial of all American wars, Vietnam, is to assess the extent to which the media's portrayal of that war has affected news coverage of our subsequent military engagements. Whatever one's political views, one must conclude the effect has been profound, especially in terms of television's coverage of our military actions in the Gulf War, the former Yugoslavia, and Afghanistan. Think back on several unforgettable Vietnam War photographs, the terrorized naked little girl fleeing the effects of airdrop napalm, the execution of the captured Viet Cong suspect in the streets of Saigon, or the destruction of the American compound during the Tet Offensive. The most devastating and lasting image, however, was arguably one we saw almost daily of dead American boys wrapped in body bags, stacked on a wharf, waiting shipment back to the States. Such images brought the war home to Americans in ways that the printed word could never do, and we did not like what we saw. We knew, of course, that wars cost lives, but somehow death did not seem so graphic or final when portrayed as a newspaper statistic or in countless simplistic and often trivial movies and best-selling novels. The disturbing television images of Vietnam became more than most Americans could handle, and they certainly fueled the growing peace movement. Both supporters and opponents of the Vietnam War agreed that these images put tremendous pressure on Washington to end the war. After all, 60 million Americans watched the evening news, and the key word is watched. So when CBS's Walter Cronkite, after a 1968 visit to Vietnam, told the American people we were not going to win and must therefore seek an honorable peace, President Lyndon Johnson correctly acknowledged, "If I've lost Walter, I've lost the country." Over the ensuing years, military proponents of Vietnam have continued to insist they would have eventually won the war if government leaders had not caved in to popular opinion. The Doves, on the other hand, praised the media for helping end the war and for encouraging us to employ caution before once again committing American soldiers to distant shores. So where does this leave the media today? Certainly the military has become very successful in controlling the news cameras, simply by keeping them away from the front lines. During the Gulf War, we saw little but sterile diagrams of smart bombs and sanitized briefings of what the military wanted us to know. The same was true in Bosnia and Afghanistan. And nothing will likely change if we go to war with Iraq. In the name of safety and national security, reporters and their cameras will be kept away from the death and carnage, and the American people will see only what the military wants them to see. Such a policy is reminiscent of what a long-forgotten sage once said about all military endeavors: the first thing lost in war is truth itself.
You've been listening to Lou Carlson, author of We Were Each Other's Prisoners, an oral history of World War II American and German prisoners of war. And finally, as we do each week, we recommend to you a site where you can learn more about the subject of this week's program, the role of the media in the Vietnam War. Joey Skidmore returns to tell you about it.
As the camera moves in, we see a little girl picking off and counting the petals of a daisy. In the background, another voice counts down, 10, 9, 8. As the camera moves in closer to the girl's face, an atomic bomb explodes and we see a reflection of a mushroom cloud in the child's eyes. We then hear Lyndon Johnson's somber voice declaring, "These are the stakes, to have a world in which all of God's children can live or go into the darkness." The Daisy Girl commercial was aired during the 1964 presidential campaign, when American involvement in the Vietnam War was a major issue. The commercial raised such an outcry that the Democrats withdrew it from the media, but it was symptomatic of the role the media in general and political ads in particular played in the war. Those ads and thousands more, dating back to 1936, have been collected and made available to the public by the Julianne Cantor Political Commercial Archive at the University of Oklahoma.
Thank you, Joey, and that's it for this week's program. We invite you to join us again next week when we'll continue our series on the Vietnam War. We'd like to thank G. Kurt Peeler, director of the Center for the Study of War and Society at the University of Tennessee, for his help in organizing this series. Send us your comments either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.